Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We've got through the American election this week. We've endured another bonfire night, which was pretty noisy in my neck of the woods. And we've entered yet another nationwide lockdown. Can 2020 get any more strange? There's only about 8 weeks left of it now, thankfully. Today, we will take stock of where we are in the world, what you're going to be doing this weekend, and what could possibly go wrong. And we're kicking off with this question. Just how many different ways are there of saying the word wrong? How many times do you have to be wrong before you get fired from a job that requires you to be right? How much should you be allowed to mislead people before you lose all your credibility? And what do you have to do to make your bosses lose all confidence in your judgment? I'm not talking about Joe Biden. I'm not referring to Boris Johnson. I am, of course, talking about the Brothers Grimm, the masters of disaster, the gruesome twosome, Messrs Chris Whitty and Sir Patrick Vallance. Things got so bad yesterday that the Prime Minister ditched them all together in favour of the head of NHS England, Sir Simon Stevens, for the press briefing in the afternoon. This was after the UK Statistics Authority said this. The use of data has not consistently been supported by transparent information being provided in a timely manner. In other words, they've been peddling a load of old cobblers and the government has swallowed it hook, line and sinker. We'll talk to John Rentall from The Independent, see if we'll get him to agree. 0344 499 1000. Coming up, we are checking in on the latest from the US election count, where if they got any slower, they would probably be registered as dead. We are told there might well be a declared winner today, but then they said that yesterday as well, and this is going to rumble on for quite some time, I kid you not. 0344 499 1000. Today, I want you to do your own forecasting of things as well. Things that might happen this weekend. Here's mine. I'm going out to buy 6 bottles of wine this afternoon. If I keep buying 6 bottles of wine every hour from 2 p.m. until 8 p.m, I'll need to buy hire a van to get them home, won't I? You've already heard my deal about driving 50 miles. If I keep driving 50 miles every hour in 24 hours, I'll be in Andorra. These are the kind of predictions, which are not predictions, mind you, just scenarios that the Messrs Whitty and Vallance are actually making. Unbelievable. So, we want to hear your suggestions for what you're going to forecast for what's going to happen and what you're going to be doing this weekend. You can text me at 87222. You can tweet me at Talk Radio, at IROMG. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. Is it any wonder? This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, it has been quite a week, right? We've had the excitement of the election special that we did on Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, in which I correctly, and only me, by the way, only I correctly predicted that Donald Trump would declare victory at some point in the middle of the night before I came back to do another show at 10 o'clock in the morning when I was a little bit tired, but it managed to go on without any major problems whatsoever. So I thought what we need today is the soothing calm of a man who's seen it all before. And we couldn't find anyone like that, so we got John Rentall instead from The Independent. John, a very good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you for that introduction.
Not at all. Not at all. Very nice to see you. Actually, in all seriousness, we did think it was time for your measured analysis of the week, because it's not just the American election. I'll tell you my first question. Have the television companies in this country gone completely barking mad? I mean, I was watching Sky yesterday afternoon, and they were sort of analysing Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, and what it had voted like for the last sort of 20 elections. And I'm going, actually, people aren't that interested in the American election. What the hell are you doing?
Well, as you say, it's going so slowly, they might as well be dead. But, I mean, we had this before. I mean, I remember 4 years ago, it came as quite a shock to many of us British people how long it took to count those votes in California.
Right.
And it didn't matter because we knew the result. I mean, Hillary Clinton had actually conceded defeat at 1:30 a.m.
Right.
on election night. But what was very important was the popular vote picture, because we're just being liberal lefties. We just wanted to know how much Hillary Clinton had really won by. And of course, it took weeks for California to actually deliver anything like a final figure.
Yes.
So, you know, this could drag on this Biden Trump battle.
Yes.
Because, you know, even
will.
I mean, they've already declared that Arizona is for Biden, and yet it seems like they might have to undeclare it now,
right.
and then we'll still be weeks away from a result.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, people keep saying to me, "Oh, has Arizona declared?" And I said, "Well, to be honest, I'm not actually sure, because we were told on I think the early hours of Wednesday morning that Fox News had already basically declared it for Biden, which upset the Trump camp no end. And they're still fighting Fox News as a result of that. And Trump's got so angry that he's thinking of setting up his own network now if he doesn't win to take them on. But, you know, the thing I find also rather interestingly ironic is that all of the Biden-supporting lefty Ramonas in this country are saying, why doesn't Trump just accept the result and move on? And you go, well, it reminds me of something. I can't think what.
Well, it reminds you, you know, where have they been for the past 4 years? I mean, that's just not how Donald Trump behaves.
How they behave either. They still haven't accepted Brexit. I mean, that was my point.
Well, no, I think they accept. Well, okay, there is a minority of conspiracy theorists who think that the referendum was rigged. But I mean, I think the majority accepted that was a result. They just didn't like it, and they tried to have a second referendum.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But I mean, what I'm saying is, I didn't think this was going to turn into a row, John. I just was making the point that they were sort of, you know, rather misconceiving their own position and pointing out that people should move on when they hadn't yet really properly moved on, because they're still tweeting about it and how awful it's going to be.
Fair enough. But I mean, Donald Trump's behaviour is absolutely disgraceful. I mean, the ridiculous assertion of...
Well, turns out he's right, of course, I mean, which we don't know. So whether or not his behaviour is disgraceful surely can only be judged at the end when you find out whether he was right or not.
Well, no, but he has to have some evidence for suggesting that there's been voter fraud, and he has absolutely none. So it's been an astonishingly graceless and...
Well, we haven't seen him produce any evidence. Doesn't mean he doesn't have it. He may have given it to the authorities. We don't know.
No, perfect doesn't have it.
Well, you say that, but you've been wrong before, John. Let's move on to Messrs. Valance and Witte. He may well have done. I don't know whether he has or not. That's the point. Let's talk about Witte and Valance, because I've been arguing with you for some time about how this data that they keep producing has been dodgy. It now turns out that the UK Statistical Authority agrees with me.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I think everyone accepts, and Chris Witte and Patrick Valance virtually accepted it in front of that select committee.
Yeah.
This that they shouldn't really have shown that scenario graph suggesting that deaths might go up to 4,000 a day by Christmas.
But yeah, that's just my thing. I mean, when you say they shouldn't really have done it, I mean, these are the people on whom all of this policy has been based. This is the information on which all of this policy has been rolled out.
No, it's not, actually. I mean, as Chris Witte explained to the select committee, the real important data is the data from hospitals about the NHS coming close to being overwhelmed in the next few weeks.
In some hospitals, not in all, especially not in the ones that they didn't show that didn't have any COVID patients.
Yes, no, I mean, absolutely. But I mean, that's why they, I mean, as you say, that's why they got Simon Stevens on to do the news conference yesterday. And he was very, I thought he was a very effective and clear performer. He said there are 11,000 patients with coronavirus in hospitals. He didn't say, incidentally, how many of them had actually caught it in hospital. But no. I mean, that's not really relevant. I mean, there are 11,000.
Well, it kind of is, though, because it is relevant on the basis that if you go into hospital and you don't have COVID and then you get COVID as a result of being in hospital, then you haven't got into hospital as a result of COVID. So therefore, the number would be reduced, wouldn't it?
Well, that is true, but it's still a number that the hospitals have to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a bit like what I was just saying to Julia Hartley Brewer. You know, if I drive 50 miles today and I keep going 50 miles every day, you know, in 24 days, I'll be in Andorra. You know, doesn't mean it's going to happen, does it?
Well, no, but, unless you could suggest reasons why the spread of coronavirus is going to is going to stop or reverse, then it will the numbers of patients will continue to go up.
And well, let's put it this way. You've got a much bigger chance of getting coronavirus in hospital than you have down the dog and duck.
Well, yes, but there, you also have a chance of getting it down the dog and duck. And that is...
Yeah, I didn't say you won't get it there, but you've got a much better chance of getting it in hospital.
Yes, but it's the spread outside hospital that they're worried about.
I know, but maybe they should be more worried about the spread inside the hospital. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, of course they should. They should be worried about that, but that does not mean that their argument for the lockdown is completely specious.
No, it's not completely specious, but it is partially specious, I would say. It's specifically in places where there's not very much coronavirus outbreak. For example, the Isle of Wight, yeah, where poor old Jeremy Corbyn has run off to escape the glamour and the glitz of politics. I was there just last week for half term, and they have no cases at all. Right, but they've having right. But the pub that I was in, the Spyglass Inn in Ventnor, is having to shut down.
Yeah,
it's not very fair, is it?
I suspect that the national lockdown is an overreaction, and there isn't sufficient evidence that it'll work. Although, you know, there wasn't enough evidence that the tiered system was turning the tide. I mean, there's some evidence that it was turning the tide, and it may turn out that you know, once again, the government has overreacted too late. But
the other strange thing, John, I don't know what you've noticed in the last couple of days, but when I came into work yesterday, sort of day one of the lockdown, I saw all the same school children standing at all the same bus stops. I saw the same traffic jams that I saw on Tuesday. I saw the same number of people walking around as I walked from the multi-storey car park where I parked my car into work. There were no fewer people on the trains. I mean, it's a strange looking lockdown to me, this.
It is. It is a much lighter lockdown than the one in March, which I think is a good thing, because I don't think they should have shut the schools in March and April.
Yeah, I think that's become clear, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I do accept that there is a case for further restrictions beyond what they'd already imposed, because I don't think you can argue with the hospital figures yet. I mean, maybe they will turn out to have been worrying unnecessarily. But I mean, that graph that Simon Stevens showed yesterday was, was a genuine increase. I mean, what he didn't show, of course, was the actual capacity of the NHS, the number of beds that they've got. Mm. But it, clearly, you know, those coronavirus cases are heading, you know, quite steeply in the wrong direction.
Yes, no, I think that's true. However, the trouble is, and I think you'll agree with me on this, that what the UK Statistical Authority have basically said is that because of the way that the statistics have been presented, they have not really taken the country with them, because what they've created is a lack of trust. And what they've created is the sense and the perception that the data is being manipulated. And I'm afraid that would appear to be the case.
I think that is absolutely right, Mike. I mean, I think that is a problem. Because no sooner had they shown that graph of the 4,000 deaths a day by Christmas, than people started taking it apart and saying, what are the assumptions on which this is based? And discovering, of course, that it was based on data from several weeks previously. So, you know, that was a bad mistake, because it undermines people's faith in the sort of witty balance show. And it's very important that people actually understand them, because, you know, I mean, you've got to remember that somebody like Steve Baker went into Number 10 with his own sort of preferred data crunchers in order to try and challenge the government's advisors and their figures. And he came out rather sort of smashed in the face, saying, well, actually, you know, I think the government's got a good argument. I mean, he ended up voting against the lockdown restrictions in the end. But he wasn't able to challenge the government's figures once he got in there and argued with them face to face.
But the difficulty as well is that the government advisers are supposedly there to present a series of scenarios rather than a consensus that they've come to, which is their one argument. And once you present, as David Davis said today to Julie Hartley-Brewer, once you present a piece of paper that says to Boris Johnson, we could have 4,000 people dying every single day, you're not really giving him much choice, are you?
No, but that wasn't, as I said, that wasn't the decisive number. And Chris Whitty insists that he wasn't making the argument on the basis of those scenarios. He was making the argument on the much more limited and secure figures about what's happening in hospitals. And that, you know...
Yeah, but he didn't say that to us. That's the problem. He didn't say it to the public. And he presented that figure as if it was happening.
No, No, they presented that figure briefly as a scenario of what might happen.
Yeah, they didn't say it might happen. No, they said if we do nothing, this will happen. That's what they said.
No, they didn't. They said there are a range of scenarios. They're all different, and they showed that graph with a number of different curves on it.
I'm looking at the graph now. I mean, you might as well have said in that case, yeah, you could have 50,000 deaths a day, but that's not real either. I mean, that's not how they presented it, John, and you know that. They have presented it wrong, and they have presented it incorrectly, and quite frankly, I'm struggling to not say that they were trying to mislead the public.
No, I don't think they were. I think they were trying to illustrate, you know, what happens with exponential growth.
Well they've also admitted, though, John, that they were trying to alarm us.
No, they haven't.
They have. They said that the last time around, and it was last month when they said that they admitted to a committee that they were trying to make sure the public got the message, so they exaggerated the figures in order to scare them. That's what they said.
No, they did not say that, Mike.
I can find you the quote if you want.
Well, you find me that quote where they said they were trying to scare people they exaggerated the figures in order to scare people. I don't think that's what they said. They said they were trying to get the message across that this is serious, and you know it is serious. And of course that's why it's so much more damaging for them if they actually present figures which can be taken apart in this way.
Well, Theresa May's been having a go at the Vermont. I mean, she's the most boring and stable person in the Parliament. And even she's saying that Boris Johnson's been using this data to basically mislead the public.
Yes. Well, they shouldn't have used those scenario graphs. I think that is absolutely right.
That's a great word. I like that, scenario graph. I'm going to use that. They should have made clear, which they didn't do, that these scenarios were entirely made up based on a set of modelling which was not in any way scientific. You can't argue with any of that.
No, they were scientific and they were not made up, but they were scenarios. They were not forecasts and not predictions. And they did make that extremely clear.
Well, they were scientific in as much as I could go and stand in the lobby of the Science Museum and call myself a scientist.
No, these were drawn up by proper scientists
who were doing
modelling.
Well, they were certainly drawn up by the men in the white coats. I don't know if they were scientists.
But I've got to come back to the case they actually made. The decisive data was the data on the number of coronavirus patients in hospitals and the steep increase that was going on there. And they were drawing conclusions from the rise in the number of cases outside hospitals and saying that's going to end up in hospital after a time delay. And that is a serious case which persuaded the Prime Minister and actually persuaded Rishi Sunak as well. Now, Rishi Sunak has been a sceptic so far. He has been extremely rigorous with the scientists. He actually went through the appendices of one of their reports and pointed out some of the flaws in their calculations. But this time he had to accept that the case they were making was a strong one. And I think that does reflect.
Well, the case might be strong, but it's not true. So therefore, all else doesn't matter. And that's the problem, isn't it?
No, the case is true. The point is those scenarios shouldn't have been shown because they are based on out-of-date and contestable assumptions.
Yeah.
So they shouldn't have
wrong.
Used
we call
that.
It wrong. Uncontestable and out of date. For that, read wrong. This is what I started my monologue with this morning, that there are many different ways of saying they're wrong, but they are wrong.
Well,
aren't they?
It depends by wrong. I mean, it's, you can't prove that they're wrong
it's the future. Unless you've got a TARDIS and you can travel into the end of December and see what the figures actually are, that's been part of the problem.
The whole point is these are not the figures that are going to occur because policy is going to be changed, and therefore those are the figures that you're hoping to avoid.
But it's an unfulfillable contract because you don't know whether the figures have already fallen. I mean, what we do know, for example, now about the lockdown in March is that we believe, and I think scientists now believe, that the peak of the virus was actually before the lockdown, in the same way that the peak of this second wave may well have been before Thursday, because already the R rate is flattening. And so we might find that it's already going to start reducing over the course of the next 2 weeks anyway.
That is possible. I hope you're right, because I think that's what we want to see.
Yeah, and if that is the case, then surely that would mean, would it not, that it would have reduced no matter what the policy was?
Yes, but we don't know that yet, Mike. That's the point.
Well, I could say that to you as a scenario, and it would be just as valid as anything that the Brothers Grimm came out with.
Oh, no, because you haven't done the maths.
But it shows you why the maths is worthless, because they've done the maths and their prediction isn't any more true than mine.
Well, you don't know.
I'm not getting paid bucket loads by the public purse either to do it, to get it wrong.
But you are trying to distract attention from the hard data of what's happening.
Not at all. No, I've always backed the hard data. I've always backed the hard data. In fact, the hard data has always been my friend. I've always been the person that says, look, this is the number of people currently in hospital. These are the number of infections. This is the number of people who are dying. As I said, in the last week of October, that we have figures for 16th of October, week 42, according to the Office for National Statistics, the number of people dying from coronavirus is 6%. Of all the people dying that particular week. So that's a fact. Yeah. That's data that I've always spouted and I've always stood behind. 6%, pretty low for closing down the entire economy.
Well, that may be right. I mean, it is above the it's above the average for this time of year, and that's significantly above the average.
It's not, actually. It's not. It actually isn't.
It is.
No, the same numbers of people have been dying every week for the same period of the last 5 years, basically.
If you look at the excess deaths figures, you know, for a long time in the summer, we didn't have any extra deaths from what we expected.
Yeah.
But now it has started to edge up. And, you know, that does justify the government taking some action.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Started to edge up. Anyway, John, listen, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Very much enjoyed it. And of course, as ever, John agrees with me, finally, that these people have got it wrong. But he says you can't know they've got it wrong because it hasn't happened yet. Well, should we wait until they've got it wrong to say they've got it wrong? That's my scenario. This is Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let's have a listen to what President Trump said, first of all, last night.
I've already decisively won many critical states, including massive victories in Florida, Iowa, Indiana, Ohio. To name just a few, we won these and many other victories despite historic election interference from big media, big money, and big tech. As everybody saw, we won by historic numbers. And the pollsters got it knowingly wrong. They got it knowingly wrong.
President Donald Trump last night still saying that he wants investigations done into all sorts of dodgy dealings and dodgy voting that he claims is going on all over the country. Let me introduce you now to Jan Halper-Hayes, who is, of course, from Republicans Overseas. My apologies, Jan. Very good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
I think this election has scrambled everybody's head, to be honest. How are you seeing it? What are you thinking?
The rest of today is more of the same. I don't think we'll have an answer until the earliest December 1st. I understand some of the issues because the past 3 months, both the Democrats and the Republicans have been in different state courts arguing over different things. And although Trump wants it to go to the Supreme Court, I'm not sure the Supreme Court wants to get involved in any political decisions. So that's going to be very interesting to see.
Yes. I mean, from the legal perspective, we saw Rudolph Giuliani the other day pointing out that they were launching lawsuits in various different states. Will those lawsuits have to take place once the counts have all finished, or how does that process work?
Oh, the lawsuits have already been filed. And you don't have to wait until the counting is finished. For example, in Nevada, what the question is a lot of people that don't live there, they're claiming they voted. And also a lot of dead people have apparently voted.
Right.
And so they're going to examine those ballots.
Yes. I mean, who knew that so many dead people would vote Democrat as well? It's astonishing that some dead people didn't vote Republican.
I know.
What about when the courts will actually listen to the case was more my thinking. You know, presumably a judge can't look at the case until such time as all the votes have actually been counted.
Well, what will happen is it goes to the district court. The district court will make a decision, and if they don't like the answer, they will take it to the appellate court. And then if they don't like the appellate court's answer, they will try and get it to the Supreme Court. That is the process. They don't have to wait because, for example, they can let the overseers in to start examining the ballots before they're even done with the last 500,000, 200,000. It doesn't matter.
Right. And as far as the sort of the holding patterns, I suppose, are looking, Arizona, strangely, I mean, we did an overnight election show here on Tuesday night into Wednesday morning. Fox News declared Arizona had been won by Biden, which upset the Trump camp very, very much, as you can imagine. But it still seems to be in some doubt, Arizona. I don't quite understand how it takes this long.
Oh, because they still have in Maricopa County, which is the most populous county, they still have 230,000 ballots to count. And in the rest of Arizona, there's still over 200,000.
Right. So that count is likely not to finish today, or do you think it will finish today?
I would hope that it would finish today.
Yeah.
Is going to be really important, because if Biden ends up losing Arizona, he's 11 electoral points down.
Right.
And it puts it, again, more in play. But see, people are making an assumption that Biden has won.
Yeah.
But
well, I'm not one of them, by the way.
Oh, good. But one of the things that will happen is this is actually a situation that did happen. Okay, in Philadelphia, they were not letting either Republicans or Democrats oversee the ballot counting, which we always have people that are in there. Mm. So the Republicans went to court, and the judge ruled in their favor that they are supposed to be allowed in to observe. The Democrats have filed a suit to negate what the judge said. It's just nuts.
Yeah.
It's just, you know,
it really
it's this
is.
Little...
I mean, one of the things that I think has come out, and I think maybe everyone on all sides could agree with, is that the system for voting in the United States in presidential elections probably needs to be completely reviewed and possibly overhauled and completely changed. Because it seems crazy in 2020 that you can have such chaos, doesn't it?
Well, the way our Constitution works is that every state can decide on their practices, their laws, their rules, their procedures. Now, there is something called the Election Clause that does give Congress the power to either make new rules or alter some of the rules. And I don't understand why they didn't use that to begin with, because the Democrat whip had proposed to Nancy Pelosi, let's just call the election for a month. And we can have the funding, we can give it to the states, and that way everyone will have a chance to get their vote in. But Nancy thought that they were going to have a blue wave, which was very disappointing for them because they didn't.
Mm.
And now her speakership is in question.
Right. And it would certainly seem, even if Biden was to win, and as I say, I'm not one of those that has written off Donald Trump, because write off Donald Trump at your peril is what I always say. But even if he was to win, he's going to be a lame duck president anyway. And there are plenty of people that I would suggest would say that he won't even last the entire 4-year term and will end up with Kamala Harris as the president.
Oh, yeah. That's what we're afraid of. And we're shocked that people actually voted. So many people voted for Biden because they have rejected the woke culture. They've rejected the progressives. But she is the most liberal senator.
Yeah. And the Senate will be under control of the Republicans anyway, as far as we know, Jan,
yes.
Right? So
yes.
He won't be able to do very much.
Right. Exactly. And that's why if Trump loses, we're really okay with it, because we can then work on getting the House again and pushing some things through. But this means the Green New Deal, the getting, you know, Medicare for all of those progressive things they won't even get up for a vote.
And what do you reckon are the chances, Jan, of a sort of dead heat? Is that possible?
At this point, it isn't.
Right. Just because the numbers don't stack up that way.
Right.
Yeah, because, I mean, 270 effectively is two more than the other guy can get, isn't it?
It is.
Right. Yeah. So because, I mean, I've seen theories and I mean, there's plenty of stuff out there if you want to read into, you know, all sorts of different suggestions of what could happen. But I've seen a suggestion that has 269, 269. I'm not quite sure how that would work.
What happens is then the electors, and so there are three electors in every state, and those electors would end up voting to make the decision, right? Because they're part of the Electoral College.
Okay. Interesting. Well, listen, Jan, really interesting to talk to you. Very interesting information. And I'm sure we'll be talking for about another, as you say, 2 to 3 weeks longer about this result before it comes. Jan Halper-Hayes there from Republicans Overseas. She says this could be dragged out until December. So we'll be in lockdown until they figure out what's going on in the United States of America. And I said this to Dan Wooten yesterday. You know, Donald Trump could still win this. Loads of people have written him off. They've written him off before. Let's not forget. All sorts of shenanigans could be going on. There could be lawsuits. There could be court cases. There could be all manner of things. So don't count any chickens yet, please, in the Democrat Party, because it's not over until it's over.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham, Talk Radio.
Now, let's have a look at the statistics that didn't stack up. On September the 21st, government scientists warned the UK was on course for up to 50,000 new daily cases by mid-October. On October the 7th, Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty showed MPs in the North and Midlands a table suggesting 32% of transmission was taking place in pubs, cafes and restaurants, when in fact it was around 5%. On October the 31st, slides presented at a Downing Street briefing showed a projection of deaths hitting 4,000 a day by the end of December. It turned out that was based on old data and was actually out of date the minute that the guys had uttered it in Downing Street. Let's talk to Jamie Jenkins, former head of health analysis at the Office of National Statistics, because maybe he can explain how they got it so wrong. Jamie, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Mike.
Now, I've been saying this, as you know, for a very long time, that they've been misusing this data, that they've been projecting things which were unprojectable, if you like, using models which were not scientific in any way, shape or form. How has statistical information got this bad?
Well, I think one of the biggest travesties of COVID, not just the sad deaths that we have been seeing, it's kind of been the use of data since the start of the pandemic. We've had many mistakes that have been done. We, for example, back in the summer, we were still including in the death figures that were being published by the government, people who perhaps caught COVID many, many months earlier, and then, say, a tragic traffic accident, they would be included within the COVID death. Right. So that was an error that was fixed many, many months ago. But I think the biggest criticism for them at the moment is that a lot of these models that are being used, they're not actually publishing the underlying methodology in there. So I've worked in government in the past and worked for the Office of National Statistics. And generally, if you're going to be producing statistical papers that people are going to be making big decisions on, for example, labour market policy or anything like that, you would normally have to go through quite a rigorous process of getting it all quality assured. But more importantly, putting all the data out there so that it can be scrutinized to assess if the decisions being made are the right ones. But what we've clearly been seeing in England and in Wales, I haven't been keeping a close eye on the Scottish situation or Northern Ireland, but it's quite clear in England and Wales, the models for these worst case scenarios, they are quite scary, but for some reason, the governments don't seem to want to tell us how they're calculating the numbers.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, if I was a statistician, like any in any job where you're going to make a presentation, as we've all done, or many of us have done, to the bosses at some point or other, the last thing you want is any kind of holes in the argument. So what you don't want to do is overstretch the statistics. You don't want to overuse things or rely on things that you can't really stand up. You don't want to say things that can have a whole great big hole punched through it, or a coach and horses driven through it, as we would say. So I mean I've always found in my experience statisticians to be fairly conservative people with a small c. You know, they're not likely to make bold announcements and make sort of weird projections, but these guys seem to be doing that every single time.
Well, I think you bang on there. So in my career, when I've kind of been presenting stats, and I try and take to Twitter each day to try and put an impartial, balanced view of what the statistics are showing as clear as possible. And that's exactly what you should do. Now, I did watch the briefing last Saturday, and I was quite critical off the back of it that, not just considering the actual numbers themselves, the presentation was going into the living rooms of millions of people on a Saturday night. Most people who probably don't very, very rarely watch PowerPoint presentations with statistics. And even I was struggling to understand half of the information that was being presented. And you even had some of the, I think Valance was presenting the data, and he even said himself that this is a complicated chart. Now, I think the difficulty you've got there is if the public don't understand the data, and then we subsequently hear that the data that was being presented was actually wrong, you just start losing credibility, right? And going back to what you were saying, I think, and then you start losing the public, and then they don't believe anything you're saying.
Well, that's the trouble, and that's where they've led themselves to, unfortunately. I mean, I was listening to David Davis this morning talking as a politician to Julie Hartley Brewer on Breakfast, and he was saying that, you know, supposedly government and scientific advisors are supposed to go and present a series of scenarios, basically, to the Prime Minister, rather than a consensus. But what these guys have been doing is kind of getting a consensus and then presenting it to Boris Johnson as though that's the only thing that could happen. And then if you tell the Prime Minister, well, 4,000 people a day might die, he's going to say, Christ, we better do something then.
Well, of course, I'm quite sure that at the actual SAGE meetings, they're looking at a wide range of different options and coming up with a consensus. I think one of my concerns would be that ministers and politicians themselves, they're not statisticians, so they're going to be taking the data that's presented to them and the advice that's been given to them. And if the presentations to the ministers and the Prime Minister is anywhere near as bad as the presentation that was done last Saturday, I kind of have some sympathy for Boris Johnson. He might not actually understand what's being presented to him himself. Now, you'd hope that he's getting a third eye to kind of look at the data. For me, there's some underlying flaws that we're seeing at the moment as well, is that what we don't know is that we have seen hospital admissions go up. That's, you know, that's quite clear. But what we don't know is the reason for the hospital admission. Was it specifically because of COVID, or did somebody happen to be admitted to hospital where COVID was happened to test positive as well? We also don't know. We're seeing increasing deaths in Wales in recent weeks, but the hospital admissions are partly driven in by that. But what we're also being told in Wales is that the deaths are being caused by people catching the virus in hospital. So there's a different policy response if people are catching the virus in hospital and then dying, to whether or people are catching it in the community and you want to have a lockdown. So I've been trying to ask for more transparency with the data there. And then the stats watchdog, the Office for Statistics Regulation, have come out yesterday being quite damning. And it's quite a stretch for them to intervene in this. And I think that was quite an important moment.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I thought was reprehensible, and I don't agree with the fact that they've just been using models which are worst-case scenarios, therefore defensible in some way, because they have admitted that they exaggerated the figures in order to frighten people into complying with what it was that the government wanted them to do. And at the bottom line for me is when they produced that graph about hospital beds that were occupied, you know, the heat graph that was going all dark over to the right-hand side, what they didn't do was include the first half of that graph, which was completely white, because there were a load of hospitals in Britain that didn't have any COVID patients.
Well, yeah, that's true. And I've actually asked the Welsh government recently. I wrote to them to ask, can you give me how many people were in hospital this time last year?
Right.
Because we need to have a comparison. Is this any more worse than it is this time last year? And they wrote back to say they don't know how many people were in hospital last year.
Well, the answer is actually they're not, Jamie, because we've seen figures, have we not, from the last 5 years. And the average number of deaths is around about 5,000 and something. And it's not much more than that.
So at the moment in Wales, we're seeing deaths pretty much in line with the average. It's slightly up in England, and you might find that it's a bit higher in the north than there is in the south. It's quite clear that the data is showing that you probably need a differential response. And, and the tier system may have actually been working, because I've been tracking hospital admissions in the Northwest. And we've actually seen, ironically, in the 4 days before the national lockdown kicked in, the number of people going into hospital in the Northwest was actually coming down. So it might be that the policy that was already in place was working, and locking the whole of England down was a disproportionate response.
Well, indeed, because I was talking to John Rensell from The Independent in the first hour this morning, and I said to him that what we know now from the first outbreak was that the infectious peak was probably before the lockdown happened, towards the end of March. We've been told that, so I have no reason to disbelieve it. Now, I'm also under the impression that it's possible that the second peak has already hit before this lockdown begins. So, effectively, the lockdown will bring the infection rate down, but it may have already been coming down.
Well, that is true. And the difficulty you have now is, when you do have a lockdown come in, it's then difficult to infer what would have happened if we didn't have a lockdown come in. So Wales has gone a little bit earlier on this. So we had a fire break in Wales a couple of weeks back, and the percentage of people testing and coming back positive has kind of been going up and up and up. Now, we have seen in the last few days that the percentage of tests coming back positive has stopped going up, and it's kind of stalled, but it's reached kind of 20% for Wales overall nearly, and 30% in areas of Wales. But there'll come a point where the graph can't continue going up and up and up anyway. So so it's difficult to infer exactly what would have happened if there wasn't, say, a fire break in Wales.
And we had a caller from Bridgend on in the first hour as well, who said that, as far as his information is concerned, Merthyr Tydfil has now got the highest rate of infection in Britain, 700 per 100,000 or something. Is that your understanding?
Yep. So Merthyr has continued to rise and rise since the middle of September. It is in one of the worst situations in kind of not just Wales, but in the UK overall as well, which is concerning. I think for me, the data would suggest that the kind of what is driving the policy, is it the data or is it kind of politics? Because if the argument in Wales 6 weeks ago was Merthyr's rate of positivity was over 5%, so we should have restrictions. On Monday in Wales, restrictions are eased, when the positivity rate is going to be around 30%. So what's changed in 6 weeks for the policy to be completely different? That's what's kind of confusing to the public.
Right.
That data seems to be used to justify one decision, but then data that shows a different thing, kind of a different decision is made, for example.
Well, I mean, the UK Statistical Authority says this: as a result of what's happened, there is potential to confuse the public and undermine confidence in the statistics. It is important that data is shared in a way that promotes transparency and clarity. It should be published in a clear and accessible form with appropriate explanations of context and sources. And that's exactly what they haven't been doing. And that is as big of a slap in the face to not only Messrs. Valance and Whitty, but to the government as well, as I've ever seen.
Well, yes, I say it's unprecedented for the statistics kind of watchdog to intervene in these situations. And even the transparency is one issue. But I think another travesty has kind of been the impact of devolution on all of this.
Yeah.
Because you can't kind of make comparisons between Wales and England, because Wales will publish some data, but England won't. But then England will publish some data and Wales don't. So when you're trying to actually think, who's getting this right? Is Wales getting it right? Is England getting it right? Is Scotland getting it right? You can't actually make some of those comparisons as well. And if you ask for the data, and I've been repeatedly asking Public Health Wales, for example, on Twitter for data, you just don't get a response.
No.
It's quite concerning, really.
And that's not really acceptable as far as I'm concerned, because the other thing that I've always said, and I said this about Mark Drakeford, you know, when he put Wales into this fire break lockdown, he did not reveal what the sort of measure would be at the end of it as to whether it had been a success. So, I mean, how will you count it, whether it's a success? I mean, if Merthyr has got that many infections, I would say it's not a success.
Well, I said, I was talking about this a few weeks back, and I actually said before they announced the fire break that the difficulty in Wales is they announced it and there was speculation it was going to be for 2 weeks, but it was going to be difficult to know if the fire break had any impact within the 2 week period. And then Mark Drakeford and Vaughan Gethin, the health minister, then started coming out themselves saying, we won't know if this has worked when the end comes. And then you start thinking, well, there can't be many times where you implement a policy of such importance and then you end it without knowing if it's been effective or not.
Right.
So I think that is another concern with regards to how the kind of the pandemic and the use of data has been used.
Yeah, and I mean, looking at things like test and trace, which we were told was going to be a sort of game changer, it was going to be the way out of this particular pandemic crisis. We were going to be able to make sure that we knew all that we needed to know. I mean, that's been an unmitigated disaster. It hasn't really worked in any way, shape or form. We found out at the weekend that the risk level was set on the app to the wrong measurement, so people weren't actually getting contacted. Those who were getting contacted weren't necessarily doing what they were supposed to do. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm struggling to think of something that has actually done what it said on the tin.
Well, there's actually a big, I think, a fundamental flaw potentially with the whole test and trace system. So the Office for Financial Statistics actually go out and do a random tested survey. So they don't ask people to come forward if they got symptoms. They just randomly select in households and asking them to take tests. Mm-hmm. And what that survey actually shows is that 2/3 of people who are testing positive for COVID haven't got any symptoms.
Right.
So if you think then that they've got plenty of people going about their ordinary day business, no symptoms, who've got COVID, they're never going to be picked up in the test and trace system. Right. So it kind of identifies a clear flaw. And then now what we might see is this new thing that's going on in Liverpool at the moment, where they're asking people to come forward regardless of if they got symptoms or not. And if that shows the exact same thing, then we quite clearly know that to get on top of this virus, just asking people to come forward with symptoms for a test and then asking them for isolation is not going to go far enough. And I think, again, that's another bit. None of that was communicated last Saturday by Balance and Witty with regards to all of that.
Well, that's the trouble, isn't it? Because in the end, you'll also have a problem with getting people who are perhaps those who are only paid for going to work and not for being off, basically, well, who won't want to get tested if they've got no symptoms. Because if they do get tested and they test positive, they'll be told they have to isolate for 2 weeks and not work.
And again, that's another policy that's kind of come in that would discourage people to go in testing. So, yeah, you kind of bang on there.
Yeah, exactly right. So, I mean, as far as the way forward here is concerned, you know, I think we can take it as read that the government have certainly lost the dressing room as far as the public is concerned on this data. So what should they do? I mean, if you were able to give advice right now to Boris Johnson and say to him, look, when Valence and Witty come waddling into your office tomorrow and start producing all these graphs, what should he say to them?
Well, I think first thing is that it's quite clear that COVID has been causing some issues across the country, and we've seen increasing admissions, and it is sadly leading to deaths. Mm. What we don't know is how many of those deaths were specifically caused because of COVID, and how many was it where somebody had a positive test. But so what you need to look at are the number of deaths over the norm for the time of year, and that's disproportionately different in some parts of the country than others. So that's the most important thing that we need to track. And then look at the effectiveness of the different tiers that were in England. And you need to kind of assess that, okay, have things worked in the north, and are they kind of working in the northeast versus the northwest, et cetera, the different tiered approaches. Those are the kind of questions that need answering. But it seems to me that before they've even assessed if their tier system policy was working, they then went for the national lockdown approach before even assessing kind of the tiered system approach.
Right. Yeah, I thought that as well. I thought it was a bit too hasty, wasn't it?
Well, to kind of say the data is showing that in the northeast we are seeing a fall in hospital admissions, and hopefully that will then reduce to a fall in deaths, because the tier system is quite restrictive. I think the difficulty you have, whether or not it's a national lockdown or a tiered system or a fire break like you've got in Wales, is that it's quite clear that for many members of the public, they've got this lockdown fatigue now. And even the measures that are coming in, people are kind of not following them all to the letter of the rules, etc. And as you've until you can get the public to be compliant and kind of adhere to things, whatever policies you've got in place, it's going to be difficult to reduce the infection rate down.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Jamie, thank you very much indeed. Very sensible conversation. Jamie Jenkins, former head of health analysis at the Office of National Statistics. I wish you were in charge of Downing Street's data management, because it would be an awful lot clearer and an awful lot more sensible and an awful lot less hysterical. Because I think that's what's been going on here. We've basically had hysterical scientists running about, waving their arms in the air, going, oh, help, 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 do something, please. Please do something, anything, doesn't matter what it is, just do something, for God's sake. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham, Talk Radio.
Now, let us, without further ado, check in with Lisa Francesca Nan, travel journalist, host of the Big Travel Podcast, of course. The news overnight came in that basically Germany and Denmark were put on the no travel list, or on the quarantine list, as it were, the naughty list. But, of course, you can't really go anywhere anyway now unless you can convince somebody that it is for business only. Lisa, very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Now, we've not spoken for a while, but it's gone from sort of, well, there's a couple of places you can still go to, actually, there's now nowhere you can go.
Yeah, we're not allowed to go anywhere, let alone the pub or anything like that. We're not allowed to go anywhere on holiday. You could be fined up to £6,000. You can, however, go after, if you're thinking of booking for Christmas or anything. You can go to the Canary Islands, you go to Cuba, Gibraltar, although who would want to go to Gibraltar for a holiday? I have no idea. Okay, for a weekend. I'm not recommending it for a week or anything more. Greece, Madeira, there are places you can go. But of course, right now, we can't go anywhere. And we've been said, actually, that this is the case until December the 2nd. We don't really know at the moment. But there is good news, like you said, is that the government, remember last month they set up the Global Travel Task Force?
Yeah.
To look at the 14-day quarantine period. We're going to hear next week something I'm very excited about indeed, to see whether that is being reduced. They're talking about maybe reducing it to a week, possibly even 5 days at the moment, which can only be good news for those of us who want to travel and also for the travel industry, of course.
Yes. And how would that work then? Would there be sort of testing at either end of that?
They're talking about testing at the moment. Do you remember we spoke a couple of weeks ago and they've actually started testing at Heathrow? It's going well by all accounts, but it's only to Hong Kong at the moment. So, I mean, people aren't meant to be travelling anyway. Hong Kong, I guess you can get away with a lot of business travel.
Yeah.
So they would either test, they're talking about the details at the moment, either test before you travel and definitely test when you come back after that 5 day or possibly 7 day period.
Right.
That's going to open travel up to a lot more people, but it's still got not going to open travel up significantly. But then the world isn't open, is it? So, you know, who knows what's happening?
Well, that's weird, isn't it? Because, I mean, one of the things we always learned about Scandinavia was that Scandinavia was held out as a sort of beacon of hope because, one, Sweden was meant to have handled things a lot better, although there's been some questioning of that recently. But whenever people who were knocking Sweden would talk about Sweden, they would say, but Denmark's actually done a lot better than Sweden. So, in fact, Sweden should not be held up as the beacon of hope. But now they're both on the list.
I don't know. Probably some people will be like me and thinking, you know, could I get away with a cheeky weekend in Stockholm or in Berlin? And of course, those are now off the menu. This Denmark thing came over literally overnight. Grant Shapps tweeted this morning to say there's this new strain, apparently, of coronavirus coming from mink. Who knew there was such big mink farming?
Yeah, I didn't.
They're apparently going to slaughter 17 million minks in the next week or so, which is just hideous.
Maybe you're going to find out that they all voted for Joe Biden while you're at it.
Nah, don't get me started, Mike. You know that you and I are on different sides of politics.
I'm not. Listen, I'm in the middle. I'm not on anybody's side. I'm a purely impartial journalist in this.
No, of course. Of course. I forgot about that.
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And me too. But yeah, so now you can't go to Denmark or you can't come back to Denmark without quarantining, with or without the 17 million minks that they're going to slaughter. But, you know, there are going to be people stuck in Denmark and they had 3 hours notice to come home. You know. Mm. But I guess the thing about traveling at the moment is if you can wing it in any way, that the one thing that is guaranteed is it's going to be subject to change.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I found very odd indeed was on Wednesday evening, the roads out of London were all absolutely chock-a-block with people who apparently, as far as we know anecdotally, were driving out of London, which one can only assume was to go to their country homes or their second homes, to get out of London before the lockdown hit on sort of Thursday morning, early hours of Thursday morning. One, I didn't realise there were so many people that had second homes. And second of all, I guess if they are in those second homes now, they're stuck there until December because you're not really supposed to travel, are you?
And also the second home people, you know, the people down in the people who are receiving all those second home people. And no, I had no idea there were so many people where this exodus came from.
Yeah.
But it seems to be an exodus. But the people down in Cornwall and Devon and Norfolk and all the places where these people are going to can't be very happy either. I mean, I'm in Brighton and I went for a walk along the beach yesterday.
Right.
And it was like a holiday down there. I mean, I'm not complaining. It's lovely. It's beautiful and it's sunny. But because people are coming out of the pubs and the cafes and the restaurants, they're all walking along the beach. So
Right. They're
all those Londoners are going to be walking along the beach in Cornwall. I'm sure Cornwall's not going to be very happy either.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, it would appear to me anyway at the moment, as I come in and out of work, because I need to be here because so that we can do what we do. You know, the streets of London on my way in, because the schools are still on, are just as busy as they were on Tuesday and Wednesday. I mean, to me, aside from the fact that you can't go to a pub or a restaurant, there's not much else that's different, really.
I get that, you know, and I'm no lockdown vigilante and I will stick to the rules because the rules have been given. And I do get that if you're in a closed, a confined space,
in a bar and a restaurant. You know, awful it is for the restaurant, bars and owner. And believe me, I'm a massive fan of pubs and restaurants. I want to get out there as soon as possible. I can see how you're obviously less likely to catch a virus sitting in a pub. More likely to, you know, in an enclosed space. But people have been saying the same about airports and airplanes. And apparently, scientifically, although you have to see where who's commissioning the surveys, but a lot of the surveys say that it's actually really, really safe on a plane and really safe at an airport. And there are, by the way, flights that are still going. I've got friends that are flying back on the 16th from London to Malaga, and those are still going at the moment. So there are places you can go to if you have those valid reasons.
Yes.
It's all a strange place at the moment, though, isn't it, Mike?
It really is, yeah. And I mean, we heard this week, I think, from Ryanair and Michael O'Leary, their boss, that basically if you have booked with them, they will not give you a refund now. When I heard that, you know, I kind of understand their logic because, you know, they're a company, they've got people to pay and all the rest of it. But I wasn't aware that they could do that because my understanding from, you know, the first set of rules was that they have to give you a refund if you ask for it. So where do people stand if they've got tickets with Ryanair?
Well, it is very much a grey legal area because this has never happened before and it's unprecedented. According to European law, we should be able to get a refund on our flights. I've done exactly the same this week. I've actually cancelled EasyJet flights and eventually I've got a voucher instead of asking for the refund. And EasyJet say you can get a refund, but please, you know, they want you to take a voucher because we're in a very strange position now, Mike, that we actually might be keeping these companies afloat by not getting our money back and saying we'll have a voucher for future travel. Ridiculous as that sounds, you know, these massive companies might very well be in trouble soon. So Michael O'Leary and Ryanair, I mean, who knows how they will get away with it. I don't know how many people are going to take them to court, whether that will actually happen, who has the money to do that. Someone at some point might, you know, with some sort of Gina Miller of the travel world might be able to. I'm not saying that's going to be me.
Well, do you know, I mean, if you can afford it, I would suggest that it's actually not a bad idea to leave the money in the company because apart from anything else, it's a kind of mental note to yourself that you have got a holiday to take at some stage, you know, that you'll be able to go somewhere.
That's exactly what I've done this week. I had to make that decision and EasyJet said to me, you can have the money back. You'll get it back within a week. You know, whether I would or not, I don't know. But it was 700 quid. And I'm thinking, actually, of course, we could all do with that right now. But actually, that's my saving towards the next holiday. And also it goes some way to help keeping EasyJet afloat. Ridiculous as that does sound.
Although I once had a ridiculous situation where a friend of mine was skiing in sort of southern France and had a really bad accident. And I was living in Scotland at the time and I bought a ticket on Buzz, I think it was, which was then still a valid airline, to Lyon from Stansted or something like that. And then when I was about to fly out to see him, he was medevaced back to Britain to be taken to hospital here so that he could be fixed up here. And he's all right now. Anyway, so I had to keep moving this ticket. And I think I bought it for 40 quid. But every time I moved it, they charged me another 40 quid. By the time I ended up going to Paris on it, which was about 2 years later, I'd spent about 300 quid on the ticket that cost me 40. So as long as they don't start doing that, you'll be fine.
Well, they do start doing that, and the airlines were waiving the change fees because you obviously have to pay to change the date, you have to pay to change the name, you have to pay to change everything. And the airlines at one point were waiving those because of the virus and the unprecedented travel situation. And now, as far as I'm aware, none of them are wavering it at the moment. So that will happen. You know, you could get 50 quid flight to, you know, EasyJet flight that will sort of accumulate. So my advice is, and my I had to weigh these options is take the voucher if you can afford to take the voucher and you can live, you know, without starving, without getting that money back. Is there, take the voucher at the moment rather than keep changing flights as well, which will do what you do and accumulate all that extra money.
And as far as the future goes, and I'm not asking you to have a crystal ball, but I know they were talking about making some kind of travel corridors, possibly. And two, very interestingly, for my own self, sorry to be selfish, one to New York and the other to Dubai. What do you think the likelihood of that is coming as we are up to Christmas?
It's really interesting, the whole travel corridor situation. And like you said, it changes all the time. And I could say I don't have a clue, but I'm going to try and wing it.
Okay.
I think the testing will be the issue and reducing the 14-day quarantine. I think that will be the thing that's coming up next.
Right.
Corridors, they didn't release, you know, sometimes on a weekly basis, they say that somewhere is back on the on the air corridor list. Greece and Portugal went back on and went back off again. They haven't released any more places this week from the corridor and said you can go there. They might in a few weeks' time, who knows? But I think probably what we've got to keep our eye on, the thing that I'm getting excited about, is this government global travel task force that they set up last month. There's going to be an announcement next week. So that's the one that I've got my eye on at the moment. It doesn't really matter about travel corridors. If you only have to isolate, I say only, there's still lots of people that wouldn't be able to get away with another 5 days off work, but it will open it up a little bit, I think.
Well, I've said this to people. I mean, like my daughter wants to come for Christmas, and for her, if it was only a 5 day quarantine instead of 14, it would really make a huge difference to her. And for people coming for Christmas, you know, you don't have to take, you know, an entire 3 week period off to actually go and visit your relative. You can actually do maybe a week and a half or 10 days or something like that. But I must tell you, I mean, I went away to the Isle of Wight last week. I took a week off finally this year. And I must say, I didn't enjoy sitting on the old ferry, even though it's only 40 minutes, with a mask on, and be surrounded by other people wearing masks. And so I'm still not quite sure if I'm there yet to go on a plane, go to an airport, wear a mask for 2 hours before you get on the plane, wear it on the plane. You know, I'm not sure I could do that.
You know what? I get back from Spain in the summer. We had to wear masks all the time walking down the street. And the jury's still out on masks, isn't it? I mean, Spain's levels have been rising very highly, and everyone wears masks in the street there. You do get used to it, and it depends what you want to do. You know, if you're desperate to go abroad and to see your family and to go out to a restaurant or to walk down the street, as it is in countries like Spain where you have to wear a mask, you do it. And I personally, it's all about personal risk assessment and personal wants and needs. I personally am happy to follow the laws to be able to.
Oh, of course. Yeah, listen, I'm not saying I wouldn't do it. All I'm saying is I'm not sure I'm prepared to put myself through that 6 hours of wearing a mask just to go on holiday.
Yeah, I do get that. But for some people, holidays are important, Mike. I know for you and I, you know, I know from our conversations that they are pretty.
Listen, my whole life's a holiday, Lisa. I mean, you know, this is why I can handle it.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, it is.
Well, listen, great to talk to you. And when are you hoping to go back to Spain, if you can?
I've just given up. Like a lot of people, I thought about going for Christmas, and unfortunately, I've just given up. So my plan B is becoming operational, is that bringing my family home from Spain to here in Brighton for Christmas. So like a lot of people, we'll be making those decisions. You know, it's just something we've got to do. But we really want to see each other. You know, my parents are 81 and 77. You know, there's some risk involved. But, you know, we all sort of calculate our own risk. Yeah. And I know a lot of families around the UK will be doing the same in time for Christmas.
Absolutely right. Well, listen, Lisa, hopefully we will see you soon. Maybe once the pubs and the restaurants reopen, you can take a trip up to London and we can have lunch or something like that. We shall see. Good to talk to you, Lisa Francesca Nan, who is, of course, a travel journalist, host of the Big Travel Podcast. I mean, many people that are listening to this will have, I suppose, been away on holiday. Whether or not you're going to be able to get what you want around Christmas time. And we've been told, of course, that all of this 4 week lockdown is in order to safeguard some form of normality over Christmas. But everybody's stopped talking about that, haven't they? Everyone's stopped talking about the kind of rule of six and the fact that you can't have too many mixed households and you won't have a really decent Christmas because you'll have people knocking on the door to try and find out if you've got the wrong people in there. You know, it's all still very much up in the air, I would have to say. 0344 499 1000 is the number. Don't forget, if you haven't done it yet, you need to watch us on YouTube, watch us on Twitter, on Facebook as well. It's all live streaming. We will bring you the news first when it happens in America, when they start declaring winners. I'm not sure it's going to be today, but wait and see. We'll bring you the news first right here on Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let's talk now, though, about somebody else who was a rather controversial figure in history, Thomas Cromwell. Tracy Borman is here, Tudor historian and author. Tracy, I'm not going to ask you what your politics are, but certainly you could say that Thomas Cromwell was a bit Marmite, rather like Mr. Trump, wasn't he?
He definitely was Marmite. I personally love him, but there are many people who feel exactly the opposite. He was deeply controversial because, you know, that old saying about you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. Well, you can't change the Church of England without dissolving a few monasteries and making the king very rich and throwing the monks out on the street. That's really why he's had such a bad press.
And he also is a guy who makes that very, very sort of unusual statement true, which is that one man can change the course of history if he tries hard enough.
He really can.
Because he really did, didn't he?
He absolutely did. He transformed England, making it really into the country it is today. There are sort of remnants of kind of Brexit, you might say, in the Tudor period, in that it was first Cromwell who persuaded Henry to separate us from the rest of Europe to create our own independent church. I was actually asked to write about this very subject for a newspaper. Was Henry VIII responsible for Brexit? Well, I would say probably it was more Cromwell.
Right.
He was certainly responsible as well for doing away with Henry VIII's second wife, Anne Boleyn, when she failed to give Henry the son that he so desired. Now, that does paint him in rather a black way. But as I said, I actually like him. He was he came from nowhere. He wasn't a typical courtier. He wasn't a duke or a noble. He was just a blacksmith's son. And he rose to the very top through sheer hard work and ability. So that's why I admire him.
And he emerged sort of from Putney, did he not, in South London? But he was thought to have come from Irish descent originally.
The Cromwells did have Irish descent. They also had Nottinghamshire descent, but it was Putney that Cromwell was born in. Now, today, if you're born in Putney and you go on to do well in politics, nobody would bat an eyelid. It's rather a nice part of London, but it definitely wasn't. Well,
famously,
in the late
15th it's famously
century.
Now the only Labour gain in the last election, isn't it, I think?
Well, be that as it may, it certainly wasn't a nice place to live in the 15th century when Cromwell was born there. And his father was notorious. I think he was in front of the courts about 43 times for various offences. So it was completely against the odds that his son Thomas would go on to this dazzling career in politics.
Yeah, and I mean, interestingly, notwithstanding that most of the Irish people who came perhaps to Britain back in the day would have been Catholic, he was a Protestant and a committed Protestant, but he also spoke Italian, apparently.
He was a real cosmopolitan gentleman because he left home at a very early age. He might have been as young as 12 when he escaped the family home, fled to France, became a mercenary, but then turned up in Italy and got his first big break. He got a job in a rich merchant's household, learned Italian, may have read and met Machiavelli. He certainly met the likes of Michelangelo and the great artists of the Renaissance. So that gave him a real edge over his rivals in Henry VIII's court. The fact that he could speak several languages, he was well-travelled, well-read. And so even though he had been just a blacksmith boy, he bettered himself to a quite astonishing degree.
So that's quite surprising in a way as well, isn't it? Because you wouldn't think of Tudor society as being particularly socially mobile, but clearly he was able to move up in the ranks to become a sort of courtier.
Absolutely. This was completely unusual. People didn't really leave their own village, let alone country. And yet Cromwell had travelled to France, the Netherlands, Italy, and that had given him a training like no other. This wasn't the age where people had a gap year and went travelling. You know, Cromwell really had a gap decade. He spent about 10 years in Italy and the Netherlands, learning his trade, picking up contacts. And he put that to very, very good use when he got back to London.
And I'm told he was very popular with women of a certain age. I know that could be something that you're not supposed to say these days, but he did seem to be very popular in that area.
He did. He got on very well with women. I think really he was influenced by his childhood when his mother was the dominant figure. By the way, he claimed that his mother was 52 when she gave birth to him, which is obviously quite astonishing if true. He had an elder sister who he was very close to. And throughout his life, he seemed to be drawn more to women than to men, although, of course, Henry VIII was a notable exception to that.
Yes, indeed. And he did have children, didn't he?
He did. He had a son, Gregory, and he had two daughters, Anne and Grace. And this is one of the things I love most about Cromwell. He invested as much attention and expense in the education of his daughters as he did in his son. Now, that's not surprising today, of course, but it was in the Tudor times when nobody bothered to educate girls because their only ambition really was to marry well.
Right. And so at what point did he sort of, discover that he wanted what he did in the, you know, what do you think motivated him from, you know, being a blacksmith's son into becoming, you know, part of a very powerful kind of ruling class?
Well, in a shameless plug, that very question is at the heart of my new TV series.
Excellent. Well, listen, we're all about shame. We're all about shameless plugs here. Please go ahead.
Well, it's The Rise and Fall of Thomas Cromwell. It's going to be out next year. I've only just finished filming it. But yeah, just quite what drove him. That is such a mystery. But he obviously wanted to better himself. He didn't want to just be a kind of trainee blacksmith in Putney following his father's footsteps. But I think it really helped that in the 1520s, so when he was back in England, he attracted the notice of Henry's then right-hand man, Thomas Wolsey. Now, Wolsey was a very good man at spotting potential in others. He himself was lowly born. And so he and Cromwell really became like two peas in a pod. Mm. And it was Wolsey who introduced Cromwell to royal circles, to the court of Henry VIII. And really, there was no looking back.
Right. And unfortunately for him, he fell out of favour with the king, which, of course, in those days only had one ending, didn't it?
I'm afraid so. You might say that Wolsey had a lucky escape, because he actually died when on his way to meet his reckoning at the Tower of London. But he only made it as far south as Leicester, and he died of natural causes. You could say that was a stroke of luck for poor old Wolsey. It sent out a real warning, though, to his successor Cromwell, who quickly replaced him in Henry's service, that, you know, don't mess up.
No, quite. But in the end, Thomas Cromwell did mess up, didn't he?
Well, yeah, although it wasn't really of his own making. He certainly didn't do himself any favours by arranging a marriage for Henry to Anne of Cleves. And that was an absolute disaster, because famously Henry couldn't stand the sight of her when he first met her in 1540. But Cromwell did actually recover favour. And it was more thanks to some backstabbing amongst his fellow government ministers that Cromwell fell from grace. Honestly, it's so resonant of today. There was a quote that it said that Westminster was full of great snarling in those days.
Yes, well, as you say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But is, I mean, the Tudors, for some reason, and I mean, you'll be probably able to tell me, it is the most fascinating period of our history, I would think.
And I think it's because you couldn't make it up. You have a king who marries six times, the Virgin Queen. It's a very confident age, the likes of Sir Walter Raleigh, William Shakespeare. And it really was the beginning of a national identity, I think, for this country. So little wonder it's so popular. And I think really just because it is so dramatic.
Yes, I think absolutely right. So give us another shameless plug for your show. And who's do you have somebody portraying him in it? Or is it just a sort of straight on documentary?
It's a documentary. We do have a little bit of recon, a bit of sort of historical interpretation in that. But it's really a documentary in which I chart the rise and fall of this extraordinary person. It's a two-parter, Channel 5, as I say, out next year. And precisely when, I don't know, but hopefully the first part of next year.
Brilliant. Great stuff. Well, Tracy, thank you very much indeed. Tracy Borman there, Tudor historian and author, got a new documentary out about Thomas Cromwell coming up next year. And I mean, there's a great cartoon, actually, in a Pew cartoon, I think it is, in the Mail today, with a couple sitting on a couch going, there's nothing left to watch. We watched it all during the last lockdown. I think there's a lot of truth to that. We had Bill Burrows on yesterday telling us about a couple of things. But I was looking around last night and I was thinking, God, 4 weeks of this. I'm not sure I can handle it. I don't know. Maybe I'll have to start just making my own movies to watch or something. Who can say? This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.